The National Catholic Register is the essential and reliable source of news and views for Catholics. Subscribe today. Go to EWTN.com and click on the link for The Register or call 800-421-3230.
From the National Catholic Register, this is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Today on Register Radio, Tim Drake interviews David Pierre about the U.S. Catholic Bishops' annual audit and the media's misrepresentation of the data. Also in our second half, Tim talks with National Catholic Register film critic Stephen Gray Donis. Always a pleasure to hear from Stephen. This time it'll be about the blockbuster movie The Hunger Games. We're hearing an awful lot about it. Well, what is a Catholic to think? Is it worth the hype? Well, we'll definitely explore all that in the second half of our program today. Welcome again to Register Radio. It's a co-production of EWTN and the National Catholic Register. I'm Tom Price, along with Tim Drake, senior writer for the Register. Welcome back, Tim.
Thank you, Tom.
You know, last week, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops released their ninth consecutive annual audit looking at reported clergy sexual abuse in the church. And of the abuse reported last year, the vast majority of it was from decades ago. Well, that's certainly positive news. Current abuse cases continue to be extremely rare, but unfortunately, that's not the way the media is reporting the data, correct, Tim?
That's right, Tom. Unfortunately, the secular media is not always looking out for the interests of the church. And to take a look at the audit and how it was reported, we're speaking today with David Pierre. David is one of the country's leading observers of the media's coverage of the Catholic Church abuse narrative. He's the author of Double Standard, Abuse Scandals and the Attack on the Catholic Church, and he is the creator and author of TheMediaReport.com. David, thanks for joining us today on Register Radio.
Thank you very much, Tim. Thank you so much for having me. This is great.
You bet. So, first of all, David, tell us, what, as you see it, what were the key findings of the church's annual audit, and what did the numbers show?
Sure. Well, you know, this annual audit is, you know, a result of the 2002 Dallas Charter, in which bishops, you know, laid out a series of articles by which, you know, dioceses would respond to those making complaints of abuse by priests, how dioceses would train and screen priests and seminarians and employees, and how the church would create safe environments for children. Now, as far as the numbers go, let me quote from the report, Tim, because this is really remarkable. Right from the report,
yeah.
It says, dioceses continue to do a tremendous job of creating safe environments by offering safe environment training and evaluating the backgrounds of its clerics, employees, and volunteers who work with children. Over 99% of clerics were trained and over 96% of employees and volunteers. In addition, over 4.8 million children received safe environment training. Background evaluations were conducted in over 99% of clerics, 99% of educators, 96% of employees, and 96% of volunteers. And it goes on to say, the Catholic faithful can be proud of the progress the church has been making in this area. A tremendous amount of resources are employed to ensure the continued safety of children within the care of the church. Now, as far as the abuse numbers go, you know, what we read a lot about in the media is that, you know, people are still coming forward with abuse claims. And one of the things we read about was that the abuse claims had gone up. But quite frankly, we have to be very aware, and like how we said in the introduction, almost all of these allegations being made are regarding events from decades ago, and that's very important. So it's really not, when we look at numbers going up and down every year, it's really not an accurate reflection of what is going on in the church today. If we look at the numbers of current allegations, that is the number of cases where a priest is alleged to have committed abuse of a current minor, then we see actually the numbers are quite low. In 2009, the number of allegations of a current minor by a priest was 6. In 2010, it was 8. And if we look at this year's report, that number in 2011 went down to 7. So we got to stress that, you know, the current accusations of abuse against priests are actually quite rare, and there is a lot that the church can be encouraged about.
Sure, and we want to stress, of course, that even one case is too many.
Absolutely.
But the fact that overall this was being reported that the cases were on the rise, when in fact we need to separate out those cases from decades ago from current cases. And that really wasn't the way that the secular media reported it. I know that both Associated Press and Reuters had stories which seemed to indicate that abuse was on the rise, at least looking at the headlines, right?
You mean that long quote I read from the report? You didn't read that in the New York Times? No. Yeah, right, Tim. The media does its thing. You know, basically, one way to look at this annual audit is basically the church is basically handing the media a free article about what they want to write about the Catholic Church and abuse. And quite frankly, the media coverage doesn't really accurately reflect what is going on and the positive things that the church is doing to protect children. And, you know, when we get to the media coverage and, allegations, abuse, you know, a couple things that the media did not point out of what's going on. You know, when we talk about all the allegations made last year, Tim, 45%, nearly half of all the priests who were accused are deceased. They're already deceased. And, you know, 75% of the priests who were accused last year were either deceased, already removed from ministry, already laicized, or they're flat-out missing. And then, also more importantly, you know, we look at the numbers, you know, really almost all of these allegations are dating back from decades ago. Over 90%, of accusations, alleged incidents from at least two decades ago. And the most common time frame, you know, is right there in the mid-70s, almost 40 years ago.
That's right. And it's great that you're doing the work you're doing, David, to bring forward this material that isn't being reported by the media in large. I want to remind listeners, you're listening to Register Radio, and we are speaking with David Pierre about the church's annual audit that came out just a week ago. And, David, another point that I saw that was missing from the secular reports was that this report, like those before it, continues to show a correlation between same-sex attraction and the abuse of post-pubescent males by male adults. Did you find that statistic as well?
Sure, yeah. This is something, it's kind of, boy, the elephant in the room, so to speak. And, you know, this is, you know, it is, it's just a simple, plain fact that in society in general, the majority of abuse victims are female. It's a little over half female. Yet, if we look at these reports year after year, it's pretty much the same every time in that, you know, four out of five abuse victims coming forward are male. And, you know, that is something which, you know, I think really is not just has not been addressed in the media, but it's something really, you know, I think the church is looking at. You know, we have wonderful and great priests who I know may, you know, struggle with things, but they remain faithful to the church and its teachings and do a remarkable job. But this is something I think the church can learn from, and we can all learn from. And it's definitely something that is not being reported.
Yeah, it's definitely something that needs to be examined a little bit more closely. In working on an article that I did for the Register on the church's annual audit, I spoke with Monica Applewhite, who's an expert on the dynamics of sexual abuse in educational and religious environments. And one thing she said was, she said, "I've never seen an organization that was able to get a positive response for their good work on sexual abuse," which I thought was an interesting observation. She said that, you know, no matter how good the work is that the organization is doing, the media is not going to report it probably in the way that we would prefer that they would. And so I'm just wondering, you've been observing and reporting on the media mischaracterizations of abuse for a long time. I'm wondering, what do you attribute the constant negative spin to? Do you think it's possible to expect the media to report fairly on this subject?
Well, you know, I've been covering, you know, the Catholic Church and the media for a while now, and basically I've kind of resigned myself to putting these journalists basically into two categories as far as the way they look at this issue of abuse in the Catholic Church. You have one group of journalists who really, they're just kind of blindly kind of sticking to the determined narrative of, hey, the church has this problem and it's still going on, and you know, this is something that the church is just going to have to keep on dealing with now and for years to come, and they're really not looking outside the box of this, you know, firmly established narrative that's been created for the last decade or two. And then, quite frankly, you have a second category of journalists who, quite frankly, see this as an opportunity to go after the church because they don't agree with what the church teaches and what it stands for. And you know, it's something as far as you asking if this is going to change anytime soon. You know, one thing I do try to do is try to get in touch with these journalists in a charitable way, and point out to them, hey, you know, there is another side to this narrative as far as what the church is doing, as far as its child protection efforts, and you know, issues that should be raised about decades-old allegations and accusations against dead priests, against you know, men who are aren't able to defend themselves, and so forth. And so, you know, I believe, you know, as Catholics, we can put a pebble in the shoe of these journalists, so to speak, and get them to think twice that, you know, hey, there is another side to this. And, you know, and I would encourage Catholics to, you know, charitably contact journalists at their newspaper when they see something that's unfair about the coverage, and say, hey, you know, sure, look at what the church is doing, and you know, hey, you know, yep, this priest is no longer around, and what about that part of the story?
Yeah, and the other thing we should point out, and we've just got a minute left here, David, but is that when we look at the church and we look at the other organizations out there, there is no organization that is doing the work that the church is doing to the extent that the church is doing. Isn't that correct?
Absolutely. You know, open the newspaper, turn on the TV, you read about, you know, this abuse that's still going on in schools today. It's really remarkable, yet we don't see people calling for the same kind of measures that the church is doing. That, you know, I don't see school districts with review boards and annual audits as far as abuse and so forth. And, you know, Catholics can take pride in the fact that really the church is really working more than anybody to create a safe environment for children, and they actually have it on paper showing what the church is doing, and it's something to be proud of.
Hey, David, let me just ask you one more thing. Doesn't this actually point to the importance of Catholic media, things like the Register and EWTN radio and television and you know, the solid websites that are out there?
Absolutely. And, geez, it's just so wonderful, you know, shows like this and so many great websites and the blogs at National Catholic Register at ncregister.com. It's little things. We just have to keep getting the message out there of what the church is doing and what the church is doing.
Yes, indeed. Be not afraid. Thank you again, David. Really appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
When we return, we'll talk about The Hunger Games with film critic Stephen Gray Donis. And if you're wondering what it's all about, well, you're going to find out in 68 seconds, I promise. This is Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Stay with us.
Are you concerned about the way our nation and our world are heading? Are you looking for the truth behind the issues of the day? Do you need support in standing up for life, the family, and our Catholic faith? Then join well-informed Catholics worldwide who depend on the National Catholic Register to address the most compelling questions of our time. Now part of the EWTN family of services, the Register is a trusted source of news and views with an unwavering fidelity to the Pope and the Magisterium. Get the in-depth analysis you need explaining what happened and why it matters for Catholics who engage in the culture to serve Christ. To start your subscription to the National Catholic Register today, go to EWTN.com and click on the banner for the Register, or call 800-854-6316. That's EWTN.com and click on the Register subscription banner, or call 800-854-6316.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. Along with Tim Drake, I'm Tom Price. Tim, for the past few weeks, The Hunger Games has dominated the U.S. box office. Can you tell us in one sentence what this is all about?
In one sentence, we might want to turn to Stephen Greidanis, who has his 60-second reviews. But no, I will say it's a dystopic, futuristic tale that tells the story of a totalitarian government that pits teenagers against each other in a televised struggle to the death. And for a Catholic take on the story and the film, we're joined by National Catholic Register film critic Stephen Greidanis. Stephen, thanks again for joining us on Register Radio.
Thank you, Tim.
How did I do on that one-sentence description?
You basically got it.
Was it accurate?
You basically got it. The Hunger Games is an adaptation of the first of Suzanne Collins' best-selling young adult trilogy about a dystopic future world set in North America, the United States, and the world as we know it has crumbled, and a new country, Panem, has arisen from the ashes in which an oppressive oligarchy abuses the outlying districts by forcing them to contribute one teenager of each sex from each district to fight to the death in an arena that is nationally televised. So there's a blood sport aspect, a spectacle aspect, reality TV aspect, all of these things kind of converging in what is really a very topical science fiction story. It's the kind of topical tale that science fiction used to address with some regularity, but seems to have gotten away from lately.
If my understanding of the story is correct, it seemed to me like a cross between stories of the early Christian martyrs in the Colosseum, plus Lord of the Flies, plus 1984, kind of all of that mixed together. And so I was wondering, is it sort of a story like that for today's teens?
It certainly has aspects of all those things, although okay. In this case, there's certainly an absence of an explicit Christian ethic. These are not people who are being martyred for their beliefs. They're just being oppressed because that's what their government does. So it's really a kind of post-Christian culture of death martyrdom story. This is what you have not when a new ethic arises within a corrupt world, but when the ethic of life has died completely and nothing is really left. And yet there is something in the human spirit that resists. There is an innate reverence for life that remains in the human heart that you can even see attested in this story.
Okay. As a parent of teens, in particular, one who would like to see the film, I'm primarily concerned about just the very simple premise of the film, which is teenagers killing other teenagers. And so I'm wondering, is there a good reason to be concerned? Is the film, is it graphic? Do you feel that it desensitizes teens to violence?
Absolutely, there's reason to be concerned, and that's a very good point. You know, I think that there is a lot of moral goodness going on in the film. I appreciate the way that its depiction of a corrupt executive branch overreaching its authority and cheapening the lives of its citizens, debasing the sanctity of human life. Other moral aspects of the story stand out in very positive ways. And while I was watching the film, I was really appreciating all of these things, and yet it came to that scene where the games begin and there's this mad dash of teenagers for weapons and suddenly they begin hacking and slicing each other, and it's really hard to watch. Is it graphic? I wouldn't say so. It doesn't shy away from the violence, but it presents it in as minimalistic a way as possible. They've really made this it's a PG-13 film. It's not an R-rated film. So the violence is presented in a more impressionistic way than in an overly gruesome or graphic way. But the subject matter is what it is. So certainly this is not something for younger or more impressionable teens. And it's definitely something that, as a parent, I would want, if I were going to take my older, more mature, spiritually grounded teens to see it, I would want to go with them, mm-hmm. and I would want to talk with them about it afterwards.
It seems to me, I don't know, and you could address this perhaps, that it would seem problematic that it's doing the very thing that it's trying to address. And what I mean by that is it's showing the games, these games which, in this society, we're supposed to look at this and say, this is horrific, they're televising this, and yet here we are watching on screen the very thing that it's trying to make a statement about. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And one critic noted how that becomes accentuated in the transition from the book to the screen. In the book, you're participating in the games as a character. You are the oppressed.
Yeah.
But in the movie, you become the spectator. You're the audience. And how does that affect the dynamic? I think it's still possible to watch the film and to get the positive moral messages out of it, but I question how a lot of people in the audience are actually responding to this film. You know, I watched the movie with a large audience, including many teenagers. At certain points, you know, I'm not going to say that anyone was cheering for anyone to get killed or to die, but certainly with respect mm-hmm. to the romantic aspect, there's that kind of voyeuristic spectator dynamic. And it's, and in the context of the violence, that's definitely troubling. I would say that that has to do more with how the film is viewed or received than the film itself, but it's definitely a point of concern.
Yeah, I have a niece who went to see it. She said the theater was packed, and she said that the largely teen audience was, in fact, cheering, for certain characters to kill others. So just hearing that, I was somewhat concerned by that. I was wondering, what, if anything, did you like about the film? I know that there is a particular scene in the film which reminds me of what St. Maximilian Kolbe did. It's the scene of self-sacrifice. So I'm wondering what you would point to as good lessons that could be drawn from it.
There are a lot of good moral lessons, both positive and negative. We've talked about some of the negative examples of, and when I say a negative example of a good moral message, I mean a cautionary moral message, an example of how a society goes wrong about what the culture of death and the ethic of death does when it comes to its full fruition. But there are also positive moral examples. Right in the beginning, we see, Katniss Everdeen, the heroine played by Jennifer Lawrence, is just one of the best and most engaging, certainly, action-adventure science fiction heroes or heroines that I have seen in a movie in a very long time. She's very responsible. She's resourceful. But she's not an overly masculine heroine the way that some movies feel driven to make their female characters. There's a lovely scene during the games in which a character has died for whom Katniss cares, and she does what she can to honor her in a way that kind of expresses the spirit of the seventh corporal work of mercy, burying the dead. She can't bury her, but she honors her fallen comrade's body as best she can. There's a neat scene with the hero, PETA, played by Josh Hutcherson, in which he talks about wanting to try to, maintain the integrity of his identity and not let the games take that away from him, not let the government take that away from him. He says, I don't want them to think that they own me. And all of those, I think, are positive moral messages that are in the film, that are meant to be there, and that really come from the author Suzanne Collins' reflections on human dignity when she was creating the story. And she got her original inspiration watching television and seeing images of a disgraceful reality show combined with images of the Iraq War, and kind of put those together and came up with this story.
I want to ask one other thing, which is that you know, in reading the first book or seeing the first movie, in some ways, you're kind of buying into the franchise, right? So that when the second and the third come out, or perhaps more if they break it into two, as they've done with other stories, that you're following the story through two more books or two more films. And I was just wondering if you could address that overall in terms of, you know, does the narrative of the first follow through in the later, or are there more problematic elements as the story develops further?
That's an excellent question. Now, I have read the first book. I haven't read the second or third books. I have heard other people say that the story gets darker or more nihilistic as it goes on. There's certainly, from what I understand, an aspect of hopelessness in the end as to what can actually be accomplished in the political situation, even if the games are abolished, even if the government is overthrown. Mm-hmm. Will anything better be put in its place? You know, those seem to me like challenging ideas, and I'm curious to keep reading the story, but I've had enough people whose literary judgment I trust tell me that the books get less interesting as they go on, and that's disappointing to hear, because I have to say that for all of my reservations and my concerns, I did enjoy and appreciate the first book, and while I can't fully embrace the film, I certainly enjoyed aspects of it, and I appreciated a science fiction film that was actually trying to take ideas seriously for once. It's become a rare thing.
Sure. Well, thank you, Stephen, for taking the time to talk about this important topic with us on Register Radio.
Thank you, Tim.
And my thanks as well. Stephen, we always appreciate your very thoughtful and insightful commentaries. Just a quick reminder, you can follow Stephen on ncregister.com. And for a complete guide to all of his film reviews, you can go to decentfilms.com. Speaking of films, Tim, I understand you're going to California next week to cover that new film For Greater Glory, right?
That's right. There's a press junket taking place in California. For Greater Glory is the latest Andy Garcia film. It tells the story of the Mexican Cristero War. It's a very Catholic film, and I'm excited to learn a little bit more about it for an article I'm working on for the Register.
Very good. We'll hopefully be talking about that next week as well. And thank you for joining us this time on Register Radio. For all of us at the Register and here at EWTN, I'm Tom Price. See you next week.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Register Radio is made possible by donations from generous listeners like you. To bless us with your gift, visit ncregister.com and click on the Donate tab or call 205-568-9756.